spiritual practice. There are three words in Sanskrit called sadhana, which means spiritual practice, and sadhaka means the practitioner, the one who is doing the practice, and siddhi, which means what is the result of that practice. And what this verse, five verses in this hymn do is put in more concrete terms what we need to do in order to attain fulfillment that we all seek in life. Sometimes what happens is that many of us have not thought often about what is it that we want in life. And if we have thought about it, we don't always know what we need to do about it. When we take up the study of religious texts, sometimes we are just given with principles. So sometimes we understand the principles involved, but how to put those principles into practice becomes a challenge. But what these five verses do is put into more concrete terms what we need to do. But even before we know what we need to do, it's important for us to know why is it that we must do what we must do. In fact, last week, I'm a chaplain at Harvard University, and we had a meeting of all the chaplains. And one of the chaplains made a presentation on the goal of life. In fact, there is one book, there is a teacher of theology, his name is Mark Heim. He teaches in Andover, Newton, there is a theological school. Have you heard of Mark Heim?
I've heard him.
You heard him? Yeah.
Yeah.
So he has written one book called Salvations. And one of the theory he proposes is that it's possible that the goals of all religions are not necessarily the same. And of course, we know at least in terms of the way that goal is expressed. The Buddhism, for instance, speak about nirvana. Hindu texts often speak about moksha or mukti, spiritual liberation. Many of the Semitic religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, you have ideas akin to salvation or what would mean being in heaven. And of course, the idea of heaven itself is described in different ways in different texts. And so we can definitely ask whether the goal put before us by all the religions, whether the goal is same or the goals are different, or whether there is some commonality, something common in all these different goals. But what I hope to do now is not go into too much of these theological technicalities, but as human beings, as beings who seek something in life which we lack right now, to arrive at an answer which would make sense to most of us. If people from any part of the world were asked, what is it that you want in life? Or well, any of us here, if we are asked the question, what is it that you want in life? While we may still have different answers, I think where we probably all would agree is we all will agree that we want to be happy. I don't think anyone has met a person in life who says, you know, I really am longing to be miserable. I want to be unhappy. No one says that. But what would make us happy is a different matter altogether. We have different ideas about what things in life will make us happy. But we agree that we want to be happy. We agree that our present causes of stress, anxiety, worry, that they should go away. We agree that they should go away for good. not temporarily. Again, happiness is not something that we never have, of course. Now and then we do become happy. But we don't want that kind of temporary happiness. Because actually all of our life, if we see, is kind of shuttling back and forth between joy and sorrow. In Sanskrit, they call it sukha and dukkha. So there are things in life which make us happy, and then something happens and we get a few blows or something sad happens in family or in the neighborhood, and that we feel miserable. Fortunately, none of these things last for long. Even if we feel sorry, there is something later on which will make us happy again. There's something which will make us miserable again. So whole love life we see is kind of just shuttling. Happiness, sorrow. Sorrow, happiness, just going on. I think what we seek in life is a stage, a time, something which will only bring happiness and all misery will go away. And this hope gets expressed in terms of thinking of an eternal heaven. Or Hindus might think about, say, worshippers of Vishnu might think, going to Vaikuntha, be happy with the Lord Vishnu, or go to Kailas, or wherever a place or an experience or a state which will be just bliss. And all the Vivekananda put it, I think, beautifully, and that was that as human beings we become aware of certain limitations under which we function, and consciously or unconsciously we are trying to rise above those limitations. And the different ideas that we have about what will help us go above those limitations make us pursue different paths in life. So you might have heard the term Purushartha. Purushartha, Purusha is of course human being, Artha means to want. So Purushartha means what people want. And in Hindu texts, they have oftentimes been shortlisted to four. They are called Dharma, Artha, Kama and Moksha. For instance, many of us believe that it is wealth or money that will make us happy. And there is a reason why we feel that way, because we know that there are things in life which make us happy, but we also know that in order to get those things we need money. And therefore money becomes a goal worth striving for, because it is a means to bringing me things which make me happy. And so money becomes one of the pursuits of human existence, because that is something that will bring me happiness. Then there's another goal that people strive for, because we know that what makes us happy, of course, just the idea that I have lots of money itself can be satisfying, but we also know that what immediately brings us happiness is actually satisfaction of our desires. I suppose I love chocolate ice cream, and here's this chocolate ice cream, and I'm eating that ice cream, and every bite I take makes me happy, and therefore karma or fulfillment of desires becomes a goal worth striving after, because I know that every time I fulfill a desire for something that I want, it makes me happy. Then yet again, we also find that mere pursuit of wealth or enjoyment is not often enough to give us unalloyed happiness that we seek. And so people have found that it's possible not to have any money, it's possible not to have any sensual enjoyment, and yet feel a deep kind of inner joy through following a life of dharma, a life of honesty, an ethical life, a life which holds deeper values, a life of truthfulness, a life of service, life of helping other people. That can bring another kind of happiness inside. So that becomes a yet another goal to strive for, the life of dharma. And then of course there is a yet another way that people have discovered, that what prevents us from getting the joy that we seek is our holding on to things which drag us, which kind of hold us back. The more we let go, the more free we become. And therefore, moksha, or as liberation, freedom, because nothing will, it's like this. Suppose suppose someone is imprisoned for life in the maximum security prison, and you give that person wonderful food, all kinds of enjoyment, but that person is still not free. Now, if such a person were given a choice that either you stay in this maximum security prison with delicious food and lot of entertainment, or we set you free, what would that person choose? And I think most people would say, you know what, I really don't care for all this delicious food. I just want to be free. I don't want to be locked up in this tiny room all my life. Now that person recognizes the value of freedom, because that person has actually experienced bondage. So all this discussion should bring us back to our own life situation. And then we ask ourselves, what is it that I value most in life? What is it that I want most in life? It's not a question of what the book says we must want. It's the question of what do I really want? And you don't have to tell that answer to anybody. You just tell it to yourself. But be on. If we don't have to announce to the world, then we can be very brutally frank with ourselves, very honest with ourselves. And we will see that we generally seek in life what we don't already have, very clearly. If we have it, then why would we seek it? So knowledge would become a goal worth striving for if we are aware that we are ignorant. If I find deeply in my heart I lack knowledge, I'm ignorant, then I would say I want to strive for knowledge. If deep inside we feel that I haven't become perfect yet, I'm very imperfect, then perfection becomes a goal worth striving for. If I become intensely aware of my bondage, then freedom becomes a goal worth striving for. Which should make us ask ourselves, am I really free today? And there is no doubt that at many levels we are free. Politically we are free, of course. We are not under the subjugation of some foreign rule. Economically, most of us are free. We are able to maintain ourselves. We don't depend on others to maintain us. So there is some amount of financial freedom. There is some amount of social freedom. At least the way we look at it, we believe that the society here is more free than in many other parts of the world. So we do enjoy several freedoms. But would any of us feel that we are completely free? And to be honest, we will know that, well, we are not really totally free. First of all, we don't have freedom from want. We are free, but we still want a lot of things we don't have. And I am bound by my wants. I am bound by the things I don't like. Because, you see, we might think, let's say, what want can a millionaire have? Well, a millionaire, suppose one who earns 1 million would want to have a second million. They say there was one one beggar came to one house and was begging, and so the in a millionaire's house, and that millionaire simply drove him away. Get out, he said, I won't give you anything. And then the beggar tells him, said, don't show off. He said, just because you're a millionaire, there is not that much difference between you and me. While you are working for your second million, I'm trying for my first million. So want is all we all have. We are not free from it. So we really, that is one area where we are not free. A second area, if you think about it, and I think that's a more basic area where we are not free, is we are not free from our present identity. Our present identity is of a human being. We all agree that we are human beings. Does anybody here have any different idea? We all agree that we are human beings, which means, of course, we have a human identity. While it might seem that having a human identity is better than having identity of a, say, some small little animal, again, that's a very human way of looking at it. Because we human beings are sitting and trying to think about the world, we like to think of human beings as the kind of the cream of creation, that we are the best. Animals and plants and everything kind of are lower down. And so in the kind of evolution theory that we have evolved, of course, we are very high. But who knows? I mean, I'm just trying to put a different view. It's a very human solution of the problem. There was one cartoon years ago I saw where there was a monkey and a baby monkey on a treetop, and there were these school kids playing there, and the baby monkey tells her mom, "Mom, I want to go and play with those children," and the mother says, "No, you are not going to go and play with those fellows. They are not even evolved yet. They don't even have a tail." So, I mean, while we see from our standpoint that, oh, at one time, even if those who believe in the idea of evolution, that one time we had tail and the tail dropped off and now we have kind of evolved, maybe a monkey theory of evolution would be that growing of a tail is higher up in the scale. Who knows? Anyway, but as human beings, we like to think of ourselves as higher up in the scale. But nonetheless, even as human beings, in spite of having the human identity, we know that the human identity is not really a perfect existence. For one thing, and let's look at it at the physical level. There are certain things that we share as human beings. What are the kind of problems? We haven't begun the text yet, but what I'm trying to do is kind of give you a general idea about the situation in which we are, so that when we read this, not much explanation may be necessary then. So this is a kind of a preparation for what is to come. What are the different kind of problems that we human beings have? I would divide all of the problems into two categories. One is, I would say, for lack of a better term, let me simply say general problems and special problems. Now, general problems are, of course, we know that homelessness is a problem. Hunger is a problem. We know that there are people hungry in the world today who need to be helped. There are people who are homeless. There are people poverty is a problem. May not be so much problem in the developed world, but in many developing countries, poorer countries, poverty is a problem. And no doubt, these things do cause stress, anxiety, worry. But we also know that while hunger is a problem, while poverty is a problem, not every person in the world is poor. There are poor people, but there are rich people too. Not every person in the world is homeless. So these problems exist, but they are not faced by everyone. And these problems can be solved. There are a lot of countries in the world where basic poverty doesn't exist. I mean, there are people who have less money and the people who have more money, but not the kind of poverty where you don't know when your next meal is going to come from. But there are other kinds of problems, which I first said were just special problems, which no one is exempt from. And I would like to call those problems existential problems. Now, existentialism was a kind of philosophy in the last century, but I'm not referring to that. I'm using the word existential in a very literal sense. Problems connected with our very existence as human beings. Problems from which no human being is exempt. East or west, north or south, problems which exist irrespective of the boundaries that divide us on the basis of culture, religion, nationality, gender. None of these matter. Everyone has these problems. And at the physical level, the problem is, first of all, illness. There is not a single person in the whole world who can say, I have never fallen ill, or I will never fall ill. We know that's a kind of inbuilt, it's a kind of a manufacturing defect of the body. The body at some time or the other is not going to feel well. And that's irrespective of how much of organic food you eat or how much of exercise you take. Sometime or the other the body is going to not feel well. Fortunately, most of the illnesses after a little bit of treatment can become well. But illness, we are not free from illness. Our human identity does not free us from this periodic breakdown in the physical health. The second problem, which no one is exempt from, is just the process of aging. What we can do is hide that process of aging. Pretend as if you are not aging. Pretension is possible, but no one can stop the process of aging. That's a real problem. A third problem, of course, is the problem which is the most unpleasant, which is not generally talked about very often, is just the reality of death. Again, there is no human being anywhere in any part of the world or any century who can say that I will never have death. So just the fact that we are human beings, we are not free from illness, from aging, and from death. Krishna, in the Gita, there is one verse which Krishna says, Janma mrityu jara vyadhi dukkha dosha anudarshanam. Dukkha dosha anudarshanam. Dosha anudarshanam means look carefully at the defects of this world, the suffering in this world. And what are the things that bring suffering? Mrityu, janma mrityu, the fact of birth and death. Of course, we don't generally associate birth with suffering. Although, there are texts which show that no matter how much a birth can be a joyful event, it has its own painful side to it. The good news is that not many of us remember the pain involved in the whole process of birth. Some of these books go deep into a very elaborate descriptions about, of course, being in the upside down in a mother's womb, enclosed in a much tinier space. It's almost like imprisonment for 9 or 10 months. And which could be, who knows, because we were so small, little babies, then we didn't even know what that experience meant. but doesn't seem like it's a very comfortable existence. So anyway, but we still don't normally don't associate birth with that kind of a pain. But we know also that we cannot think of a birth without death. Because when there is a beginning, there has to be an end. When there is a birth, there is an end. So janma mrityu, birth and death go together. And that's a part of our existence. Jara is illness. Jara is aging and vyadhi is illness. So Krishna also mentioned, and again, if those of you have studied the life of the Buddha, in Buddha's life we know that the three sights which changed his life. He was a prince, untouched with sorrow, and when he went out as a young man, he first saw an aged person going around, he saw a person who was sick, and he saw a dead person. These are the three things he saw, and then he said, enough. If Buddha had simply seen a poor person or a hungry person, Buddha was a prince, he could have gone home and told his dad, do some socio-economic reforms and remove poverty. But that's not what he saw. None of these legislative processes can stop illness, old age and death. So now that's the problem. And that problem is connected with our human existence. As long as we are human beings, as long as we have a human identity, we cannot be free from illness, we cannot be free from aging, we cannot be free from death. And that's only at the physical level. At the mental level, of course, can anyone in this world claim in all honesty that I have never experienced stress of any kind, I have never experienced anxiety of any kind, I have never experienced pain of any kind? Again, these are characteristics of the mind which we have. So at the physical level, at the mental level, at the emotional level, and of course at the intellectual level also. I mean, how much can we know through our intellect? Even the greatest geniuses in the world, well, they might have been geniuses in one particular field. I mean, you might could get a Nobel Prize, but that is in your particular field of study. You may be totally ignorant about something else. So our intellects are limited. They say a specialist is one who knows more and more about less and less. So you have now eye specialists. So an eye specialist may know a lot about eyes, may not know much about the other part. I think a time will come when there will be a right eye specialist and a left eye specialist. Someone said, if a specialist is one who knows more and more about less and less, the ultimate specialist is one who knows everything about nothing. So, even intellectually, we are limited. The problem now is this, that in spite of all these limitations we have, most of us don't even think about it. Which kind of makes us happy, because you don't think about the problems. But if you just don't think about the problem, doesn't make the problems go away. It's like sweeping dust under the carpet, you see. And which is why sometimes it is said, ignorance is bliss. But denying a problem will not make the problem go away. And therefore we need to confront the problem. And those who have confronted this problem have realized that as long as I hold on to my human identity, I cannot be free from this. And what Vedanta offers, the solution that Vedanta offers is that stop being human. If the problem is in the limitations of the body, the mind, the ego, then as long as we are kind of hold on to this body, mind, ego, all those problems are never going to go away. So just let go. And the question is, can we let go? And the answer is yes. The good news is that according to Vedanta, We are neither the body, nor the mind, nor the intellect. So the limitations that are connected with the body, mind and ego are not our limitations. They become our limitations so long as I hold on to it. If I am not the body, mind and ego, then who am I really? Normally we use the word I all the time. I'm reading, I'm talking, I'm singing. So what, who is this I that I'm referring to? When we say I, who is this person I? And normally what we would think is, it's a kind of a mixture. Definitely, when we say I, we are referring to the body, of course. But not just the body. We know that we are not just body. Who was that? Which governor of Minnesota? What was his name? He was called the body.
Jesse Ventura.
Yeah.
Jesse Ventura, right? But so, of course, none of us really say, I am a body. We don't say that. But we pretty much mean it. For instance, when we say our gender identity, we say, I am a man, I am a woman, I am a boy, I am a girl. That's pretty much like saying I'm a body, really. Because gender is connected with the body. It's just the way the body is configured. A body configured in one way makes it a male body. A body configured in another way makes it a female body. So when I say that my identity is as a man or a woman, I'm really saying this body is me. So we get identified with the body. Again, when we say, I'm happy, I'm miserable, I'm excited, I'm depressed. Now, these are characteristics of the mind. It's the mind that becomes happy. It's the mind that becomes depressed. But when I say, I am depressed, I'm essentially saying, I am the mind. So we use the pronoun I to sometimes refer to the body, sometimes to the mind, sometimes to the intellect. Sometimes to the ego. So, but who is this real I in me? And what Vedanta teachers have said is that we are a combination of material and non-material parts. And according to their thing, that the body is material, we all understand. Because whether the body, after death, whether the body is cremated or buried, whatever way it's done, ultimately just returns to dust. It can become a heap of ashes if you cremate it. And you can't then distinguish. If you burn to ashes a tree or a dog and a human being, ultimately it will be three heaps of ashes and you can't distinguish between them. So that the body is a material object, just even it's possible to find out the chemical composition of the human body. It's not difficult. So that's pretty clear. But what these Vedanta teachers also said was even the mind, the intellect, that is also material. That may not be so easy to grasp. What they said was, sometimes, I mean, when we use the word spiritual, oftentimes we use the word in a very loose sense. We said something that kind of makes us feel a little bit uplifted, a beautiful sunset or a beautiful poem, and say, oh, that's very spiritual. Nothing terribly spiritual about just mind. Mind is material according to them. But it's subtle matter, it's fine matter. And we might, you see, it's like this. We might think, how can we say mind material? We are not able to see the mind. But there are a lot of things we don't see. For instance, no one has seen an isolated electron or any of these subatomic particles. We say nothing terribly spiritual about an electron. It's just that it's so small that we can't see it. Now the mind is even more small, more subtle, more sukshma, and therefore it can't be seen. If we think deeply, we will see that there is not that much difference between the body and mind. Basically, we know that both can get tired. We know that both need exercise. We know that when you give food, they feel strong. Well, food to the body is the food that we eat, that is we are familiar with. But the food to the mind is good, healthy thoughts, good, healthy ideas, which will make the mind strong. If we put junk food in the body falls sick. Put junk ideas in the mind can fall sick. The body has its doctors, the mind has its doctors. Pretty much everything that is true with the body is true with the mind. Except that we can see one and we can't see the other. But we can't see the other just because it's a bit too subtle, that's all. In fact, there is no dividing line between the body and mind. And therefore, because of that, because both are material, both act on each other. That is why the body acts on the mind. The mind acts on the body. Most of the illnesses that we have now, they are not simply physical or not simply mental. They speak what psychosomatic illnesses. We know that if the mind is in a very bad shape, it does affect our health. And if someone has a lot of physical suffering for a long time, it does often affect the mood of the mind. The two act on each other. Now the question is, do we have anything in the human personality, anything that is included in this word I, which is different from body, mind and ego? And the Vedanta teachers have said yes. And they call it by a simple name, the Atman. The Atman, literally translated, simply means the self. And so there is something in me which is not material, which is just pure spirit, pure consciousness. And because body, mind are material, they follow the laws of matter. There is change, there is beginning, there is transformation, there is end. But spirit is not material. It doesn't have to follow the laws of matter. And therefore, the spirit is without beginning, without end, unchangeable. So, at present, each of us, there is something changeable within us and something unchangeable. What is changeable is very clear, very obvious. If you go home and then open your all family albums and take a look at all of your photographs taken over the years, right from the time you were a baby, how much we have changed physically is very clear. When we were born, we just a little baby of a few pounds. And of course, now we know we weigh much more, we look much differently than all babies pretty much look alike. But when we grow up, we see all the differences. But not just the body, even the mind, the kind of thoughts we had as little children, the kind of hopes, the kind of ideas. We know that in different stages of our life, as we grew older, our ideas changed, our thoughts changed, our hopes changed. So the mind has been changing, the body has been changing. Intellect is changing also, but there is something which is not changing, and that unchanging part within me is the real me. The changing parts in me are what give me the human identity. The unchanging part in me is the divine identity. So at present we are kind of a mixture of the human and the divine, but because this human aspect within us, these changing parts within us, absorb so much of our time and energy that we have practically forgotten that there is something unchanging within us. We just don't have enough time for it. We don't have enough energy for it, because all of our energy is kind of taken away by... It's like this. Suppose you... Sometimes it may happen that if you use a computer, maybe you have got one really fine program which is very useful, which is wonderful, but there are a lot of things you need to attend to, other tools. So you've got your emails and you've got this and that, and by the time you finish attending to all your other programs, you just exhausted at the end of the day, and you don't have time to go to that one basic program which is there in your computer. But something like that has happened. That we don't have time to attend to this unchanging, eternal part of our being, because call it our duties, call it our responsibilities, call it our desires, call it by any name, a lot of our time, in fact, almost all of our time, all of our energy that we have, and the time and energy that we have at our disposal is very limited. No one has more than 24 hours a day. And while energy resources may vary from one person to another, still it's very limited. We can't go on working endlessly. Sometimes you're just going to get tired. We're going to get physically tired. We're going to get mentally tired. So if our duties and responsibilities and other pursuits in life are going to kind of suck away all of our energy, all of our time, then we will have no time even to think about this eternal aspect of our being. And it is only that aspect, that identity, which will free us from these basic problems. The problem of, as I mentioned before, the problem of illness, the problem of aging, the problem of mortality, the problem of death, the problem of stress, anxiety, all of these problems will go away if I can find some more time to attend to that unchanging part within me. The reason for that is the Atman, the real self, the true self, is free from birth and death. It was never born, it will never die. What was born is the body. What will die is the body. But the real me was never born, will never die. The real me will never fall sick. The body can fall sick, but the Atman will never fall sick. The Atman never ages. It's always fresh and new. The body and the mind can age. The Atman never has any stress, never has any anxiety, never has any worry. The body and mind have all of these. So now, just as effortlessly as we feel, I am the body and mind, I am a human being, if we can find a way of effortlessly feeling I am the Atman, our job is done. Because once I know I am the Atman, then I can say very rightfully that I was never born, I will never die. There is no illness, there is no death. I am Satchidananda, I am existence itself, I am consciousness itself, I am joy itself. Now what this hymn will do is show us ways by which to attain that experience. And that experience, once we get it, is not an experience of 5 minutes or 10 minutes, that you just kind of get it, feel good about it, and then go back to being a normal human being. I want to say something about normal life, because oftentimes when I speak about these things, people say, well, let's now, when we go back to our normal lives. Now, what is normal? Normal. Generally, what the majority do is considered normal. But now take this case of, let's say there is a mental institution. And of course, people are with various mental illnesses are there. And of course, there are doctors treating them. There is some paramedical staff treating them. But in that environment, the majority of the people are mentally sick. But few of them are helping them. Now, if what the majority does is normal, then the only abnormal persons in a mental institution are the doctors, right? So, we have to kind of change our definition of what is normal. Because if we consider ourselves normal now, then people like Jesus Christ or the Buddha or Ramakrishna or Shankaracharya, or any of these great beings whom we today worship as the avatars, as the prophets, as great saints, totally abnormal people, because they didn't talk the way we do, they didn't behave the way we did, they don't see the world with the same eyes that we do, and we are in the majority. So ours is a normal life and theirs was an abnormal life. Or we have the other option of seeing perhaps this whole world is a kind of a lunatic asylum. And these are the few people who became prophets and saints. They are the only ones who are sane. The rest of us, there's something wrong with us. The good news in this is that we don't have to remain this way. None of these great teachers who came have said that, oh, we have become free. You fellows, you know, eternally you will be like that. Or you just believe that we were free and that's it. No, all of these great teachers have said, you also can be free. So each of us has the capacity within us to get over these limitations. Each of us can become free ourselves. Each of us can become really normal. And what this hymn will do is show us how we can become normal in that way. So why don't we now take a quick look at the first verse? It's been a fairly long introduction. Let me read the Sanskrit first and then followed by... Do you have a Sanskrit text with you?
No.
No? Okay.
No.
Yeah. You are. Okay. You have a Sanskrit text, right? I think, but it's there in a Sanskrit script also, right? Or you have transliterated it?
No.
No, it's Sanskrit. Okay. All right. So even if you, I'm sure some of you will be able to read it. Even if you can't, you can just listen, because we have a fairly good translation. Because I think it is done by some Swami Chidananda. Okay. All right, so translation. First, the Sanskrit. If those of you who can read it and would like to chant along with me, can chant. So I will read it slowly. You can join me. Vedo nityam adhiyatam taduditam karmasvanushtiyatam. You want to follow? You would like to join me? Okay, just sing along with me. Vedo nityam adhiyatam taduditam karmasvanushtiyatam tene shasya vidhiyatam apachitiv kamye matistyajyatam papaughav paridhuyatam bhavasukhe doshonusandhiyatam atmechha vyavasiyatam nijagrihat Turnam vinirgamyatam. Okay, now the translation. Study the spiritual texts regularly and put into practice their teachings. Worship the divine in that manner and give up the thoughts of desires. Wash away the negative habit energy and examine the defects of worldly excitement. Hold on to the awareness of the Atman and leave at once your own limited identity. In the background of what I said so far, I think this will become kind of self-explanatory. Study spiritual texts. The word used in the Sanskrit is study the Vedas. Now the Vedas, Swami Vivekananda famously said that by the Vedas no books are meant. By Vedas is meant that accumulated treasury of spiritual laws discovered by enlightened beings in different times. So, although the Hindus say that Vedas is our primary scripture, and when we think of a scripture, we invariably think of a book, we need to remember that historically, the Vedas as a book is a much later phenomenon. This wisdom came much before books were ever written. It came as an oral tradition. And somewhere along the line, when then they started, of course, the paper came much later, but you know, those all parchment sheets and whichever way they noted down. But even much before that, the thoughts of the Vedas came down through an oral tradition. Nor is the Vedas therefore a book in the sense that this book is complete, because the Veda simply means knowledge, and therefore any of the revelations that have come and added to the collective religious consciousness of humanity can be called a part of the Vedas. Of course, this definition won't be acceptable to all, because this is so comprehensive. It really means all revelations, really. The human nature is thus, that we want to divide what ultimately spirituality wants us to unite everything into one, but are just our human limitations want to then divide. So what we do is the collective spiritual consciousness of the whole world, the spiritual treasury of all these revelations, we then divide it and say, these are Hindu revelations, Vedas. These are Christian revolutions, the Bible, or the New Testament, and the Judaism, so the Torah, and the Muslim revelations and the Quran. This is the human way of looking at it. But a higher way of looking at it is, why not see all of these revelations as belonging to the entire human family? Doesn't mean that we have to have all of these revelations all at once, which probably humanly won't be possible. It'll be too much of an indigestion in some sense. But doesn't matter. We can take from these revelations as much as we need, as much as it would meet or find relevant to our specific life situation. So that is why I've translated the Vedas as spiritual texts, so that this is not something limited only to a particular section of humanity or a particular part of the world, that this wisdom really is open to everyone, or to whoever it makes sense. But more important than simply studying them is putting into practice. So both are important in life. Sometimes people say, I want something practical. Sure, I mean, practical is of course great. But in order to even know what to practice, we need to have some theory. So we don't have to make too much difference between theory and practice. Because in order to practice, we must know what to practice. But simply holding on to theory doesn't help. We need to practice it either. So both a true spiritual practice would include study of the texts and then practicing. It's not enough to read in the book, say, be truthful. Truthfulness is a great virtue. Well, we all agree with that. But the question is, in my day-to-day life, how much truthful I am? By and large, most of us are truthful most of the time. Truthfulness does not become a virtue unless it is tested. Which means that there will be occasions in life when speaking the truth, I might get into trouble. But in spite of that danger of getting into trouble, do I still hold on to truth? Or telling a little bit of a lie, I might be benefited. Am I tempted to tell that lie to get that benefit? That is when the virtue of truthfulness gets tested. Otherwise, simply you ask me the time now and I tell you the correct time. I'm being truthful, but it's no great deal because I don't lose or gain anything by that. And so that is why what we study in scriptures, that must be put into practice. Only what we put into practice will nourish us. Simply reading in a book how to prepare tea and read about that tea will not nourish us. Actually, you have to go to the kitchen and prepare tea and then you drink it. Only then you feel nourished. So simply reading in a book, be truthful, be good, pray to God regularly. It's wonderful. But actually to go and do it, that is what will nourish me. Worship the divine in that manner and give up the thought of desires. Desires take away our peace of mind. That's very clear. One of the reasons then when we are fast asleep, we all experience happiness in deep sleep. Sushupti, as it is called in Sanskrit. Because there are no desires in deep sleep. And then we are completely at peace. And the moment we get up, say, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I need to run here, and all that peace and joy, everything goes away. Wash away the negative habit energy. Most of us are so much caught up in ways of thinking, ways of speaking, ways of doing, which bring us pain. And we can change that. But because we have made a habit of doing it that way, it's difficult to change. Fortunately, habit is only our second nature. And therefore, it will be difficult, but not impossible. So a lot of the things which it's like this. Sometimes in life, we might think that we kind of blame the weather or people or the government or friends or whoever. Because of that person, I became miserable. That person is responsible for my worry. If we are truly honest with ourselves, we will see that we have contributed in some way towards our own sorrow and misery. And the other person was only a nimitta, only an excuse, only someone who helped us in getting us what we really deserved. So if we now change our way of thinking, doing and speaking, we will see that a lot of our pain and sorrow will vanish. So we bring upon ourselves our own sorrow. If we can make that change inside, the outside, normally they say, can't clap with the one with one hand, there are two hands. So everything that we experience in life, both joy and sorrow, we are contributing something to it. So we can't simply blame others for what we go through. And examining the defects of worldly excitement, I have already mentioned these defects. By worldly excitement, I have meant the essential defects of our human existence, which I have already outlined at the physical level and mental level. Hold on to the awareness of the Atman. By Atman is meant that eternal, unchanging identity in our heart. And leave at once your limited identity. Limited identity in the terms of human identity. Human identity makes us mortal. There is the fear of death. Makes us, prevents us from getting that infinite joy. So moment we give up that identity, we can become free. Okay, I will stop now. So today we have done the first verse. What I plan to do is tomorrow evening we'll do verse 2 and 3. And on Sunday we'll do 4 and 5. So that's how we will be able to deal with this. So if you have any thoughts or ideas or questions about what I have said so far or anything about the first verse, feel free to say. It doesn't have to be a question. It can be even your comments. But if you don't ask questions, then I will ask you questions.
Maharaj, we say spirituality is identifying ourselves with a real Atman.
Hmm.
So, is it really escaping from our sorrow and pain? And is it an escapism from... Is it dealing with the reality of...
You're dealing with it by escaping from it. You see, it's like this. Suppose the house is on fire. Would it be considered abnormal to get out of a burning house? Or say, no. Getting out of the house, burning house is escapism. I need to be here and deal with fire. We don't do that. Right? So it just depends on how you characterize it. I wouldn't call seeking our Atman identity as escapism. Actually, come to think of it, not seeking our Atman identity is escapism. Because we are already Atman now, right now. It's not like, I am a human being now and now I have to become that Atman. That's not the case. The simple situation is, right now we are already the Atman. We are already free. We are already divine. But we have our freedom, our divinity is covered by these layers of human identity. So what we are really doing is just peeling away the human identity and just being who we are.
Is there any easy way for this escapism?
Why
is it always spirituality so complicated?
If I have made it sound like complicated, it's my defect. It's my shortcoming. Because I think there is nothing more simple than spirituality. It's like this. Essentially, the basic problem is, not problem, basic truth is this, according to Vedanta. Each of us is the spirit. We are Atman. And now, we have begun to think of ourselves as human beings. And all that these books say is, stop thinking of yourself as a human being. Just be yourself. What can be more simpler than that?
No, but people make it more
complicated. Yes, sir. In that case, why do we have so many volumes of texts and scripture?
Well,
to explain
because someone puts it in a simple way, people don't like simple answers. You see, there's one story. There was one man, and one day what happened was, this person, they got up in the morning, and the newspaper arrived in the morning, and he took the newspaper and just tore it to pieces. And then the other family members thought, what happened? Maybe there's some really bad news in it, or what? But after that, they found something very strange. This fellow, wherever they found, he found paper at home, he started tearing it to pieces. It became even worse, because then he went in his room and all his dollar bills he found, and he just tore everything. Then the family got really terrified. Some serious problem is there. So then they took him to a doctor, and then the doctors examined him. They did all the, ran all the tests on him, and they couldn't do. They gave a lot of medicine, they gave him shots, still he continued to tear paper. Then they said, okay, let's try psychotherapy. So they took him to a psychiatrist, and they put in psychoanalysis and hypnotism and all kinds of therapies you can think of. They tried everything. They got all international doctors and everything. Nothing worked. This fellow still continued tearing paper. Fortunately, it was a wealthy family, and so although their insurance didn't cover all these therapies, still they could afford to do it. But they spent millions, and still they could not cure this fellow. Then finally, after several months, one family friend visited them and said, here is this one young doctor has arrived in town. Why don't you take him there? And the family said, you know what? We have really given up hope. All these best doctors in the, all over the world have tried and nothing happened. And what could this young doctor do? Anyway, the friend said, why don't you take him anyway? So they took this patient to that doctor, who had a small little private office. And so he sat and asked them, what's the problem? And then they said, this is the problem. So then the doctor said, okay, why don't you people also keep sitting? I'll have a word with the patient. So he took the patient by the hand, and from one end of the wall to the other, they just walked twice. So the doctor put his arm around the patient's shoulders, and then they just walked. And then this doctor whispered something into the ear of that patient. And then he came and told the family, okay, he's cured, take him. The family is very skeptical, because there is no treatment done, nothing. And they thought this young man is just making fun. But amazingly, they found when they took this fellow home, he had stopped, completely cured. And then they said, wait a minute, let's see how long this continues. So next day, a week later, completely cured. They couldn't believe it. They were so grateful. They went to this young doctor and said, you have saved us. You have saved our family. Tell us whatever fees you have and we'll be glad to pay. Of course, he was a modest doctor. He said whatever fees he told, and there the matter ended. Then the family asked the doctor, but tell us, it's kind of very confusing. You didn't run any tests on him. You didn't give him any medicine. How did you manage to cure him? We noticed that day when you were walking with the patient, you whispered something in his ear. What is it? You told him. And then this doctor kind of just simply shrugged his shoulders and said, well, I just told him, stop tearing paper. You see? What was the problem? The problem was, this man was tearing paper, and no one had told him not to do it. They gave him shots, they gave him medicines, they gave him all these things. No one told him what to do. That's the problem. The problem is, well, this doctor said, what is the problem? He's tearing it, and to tell him not to do it. In spirituality, it's exactly like that. What is the problem? Our human identity is the problem. What is our real identity? The spiritual identity. So all that we need to do is stop thinking of yourself as mortal. Just be who you really are. Simple answer. People are not happy, so you have a lot of scriptures, lot of texts.
So the more we take, the more different things we take, the more complex it becomes.
Yeah. So if we are not satisfied with simple solutions, and most people are not, then only if you kind of make it complicated, then they think, oh, now we are learning something. You see.
Can one form of spirituality be that I have my daily set of problems, I try to focus on the things I control and try to solve them to my best of my ability and not get worried or stressed about the results or what comes out of it? Can that be a form of spirituality too, if I can do that?
No, it's actually up to the person. If you find that living that way, you are completely free from stress and worry, that's fine. Yeah. But yeah, you could see whether that kind of thing helps. It may not. It might help you in the immediate thing, you might. But I think at some point in life, it may not happen so much. Generally, when we are relatively young, it doesn't happen that much. But as we start getting older, the concerns that come up at that time are very different from the concerns that come up in young age. You see?
True, but I mean, at some age I should try to be the best son or daughter I can be, at some age the best husband I can be, at some age best father I can be. So it could go on like that, but I mean...
Yeah, I'm sure what I'm saying...
To a point, otherwise for me also, spirituality comes very... complex or something difficult to get my
No, that's true. What the thing is this about spirituality. Spirituality is not something that can be forced down anyone's gullet. It cannot be, it's not that because I am saying it, every one of you must become spiritual right now. That's not even possible. It's spirituality is like a hunger. And no amount of saying you got to eat this. Is going to work unless we are really hungry for it. And so all that these books do, or all that these kind of retreats do, is provide with the experiences and insights that have come from people who have gone before us, and what they have experienced, what they have found, what has worked in their lives, and so they have shared. So what we have here are insights which are not simply speculations, which are not simply some kind of a theoretical principles, but actually living principles which have worked, which have shown results in other lives. And if we believe that, well, what has worked in other life may work in mine too, then we might want to apply it. It's possible that a lot of what is said might seem like, either it might seem like, no, it's not relevant to me, or it might seem like it's not relevant to me at my present stage of life. Perhaps it may be relevant later. You know, it, different people will view these teachings in different ways. All that I'm saying is that at some point we are really going to feel the need from inside for something more, something different, something deeper than what we are already doing. And when we feel that inner hunger, inner need, that time we ourselves will go and want it. You see, no one else will have to kind of then prod us to do that. It's the example given. What is the one of the requirements in spiritual life is called mumukshutva. Mumukshutva really means the desire to be free. It's not enough to have all these books saying this is how you can attain freedom. Sure, but do I want to be free? If I don't want to be free, then the solutions are of no use. And what is the pinnacle of that wanting? What is the example given in Sanskrit text is wonderful. It says, Deepta Shira Jalarashim Iva. What would, suppose someone's head is on fire. What would that person want most? Is just find some water and put out that fire. At that time you say, why don't you have a cup of tea and then later on we can deal with it. You say, no, I just want. So this wanting to be free or wanting to transcend our limitations, that hunger can get so intense in some people's lives that they say, you know what, I don't want anything right now. I just want to be free. Now what happens is, not all of us have reached that level of hunger yet. Some of us realize that these teachings are important. Some of us realize that these teachings are good. But not many of us feel like it's something so urgent that I need to kind of begin working on it right away. Which is fine. But how much seriously, how much urgently we will take these teachings will depend on the sense of urgency that we have inside us, and that sense of urgency will vary from person to person. It's not necessary that every one of us should have the same level of hunger. It's never like that. Even when we say at home, it's lunchtime or it's dinner time, doesn't mean that everyone at home is equally hungry. Sometimes we say, I'm not hungry, I will eat later. Or sometimes we say, oh, even though I'm not hungry, let me just go and eat something. So spiritual life is also like that. So we all have gathered and we find occasions to come together to think about spiritual life. Does not mean that we are all equally hungry. But we say, we recognize, well, it's something good. And this will be useful, if not now, then maybe at some point when we become hungry. So it's not, therefore, something that kind of needs to be done right now if we don't feel the need for it.
I have a comment. at an younger age, people feel like the responsibilities have to be done, like being a good husband, a good father, all these responsibilities to be taken care of. But then they worry, okay, we have to be spiritual too. But Bhagavad Gita has a practical solution. They said, Karma Yoga, do your jobs, but without attachment.
Sure, I mean, it's a good thing. The idea is this, when I say you have to be spiritual, why do we think that being spiritual is in conflict with being a good father, a good husband, a good son? I don't think so. In fact, I think the two are very connected. In fact, if I'm spiritual, I won't simply be a good son and a good husband and a good father. I think I'll be a better son, a better husband, a better father. So why is spirituality seen as in opposition to my present duties and responsibilities? My feeling is that if we are spiritual, we'll be able to carry out our present duties and responsibilities in a much better way. I don't see it
sometimes
as a problem.
People get the idea you are spiritual means you are like renouncing things.
No. Well, you are renouncing, sure, but you're not leaving your home and going to a forest. You are renouncing your wrong ways of thinking, wrong ways of dealing with other people. And if I'm renouncing something which is harmful, it's going to make me a better person. So why?
Also,
yeah, so spirituality is not something that can be practiced only in a mountaintop or in a cave. Then otherwise I wouldn't be here myself. What am I doing here? I should have been in some Himalayas somewhere, I think.
So what is spirituality?
Being spirit. The word, you see, how did the word spirituality come? There is the word spirit, right? So what spirituality is would depend on what our notion of spirit is. And the way the word can be understood in the Vedantic perspective is that which is not material, that which is not a product of matter. So spirituality would mean anything that takes me closer to being a spirit, which I truly am. And that is spirituality.
That would apply beyond Vedanta, well beyond Vedanta. I think that would be acknowledged by people in many religious traditions.
Yeah, because that's why I'm not using any specific Vedantic or Hindu terminology. Because as human beings, we share these limitations. And as human beings, we also share the hope and belief that there is something eternal in us. And how we phrase that in theological terms would be different in different theologies. And so that eternal part in me, Vedanta calls the Atman. And so all that the Vedanta says is, be that eternal being who you are. You don't have to become it, you are already it. I have forgotten it, and just recover your memory. They say in the Ramayana, story of Ramayana, when Sita was kidnapped, and so they came up in search of her right up to Rameshwaram, Dharushkodi. Have you seen? Have you been there, Rameshwaram? So that's where then they saw, of course, the ocean, the Indian Ocean, and Sita was in Sri Lanka. And how to go there to find out. And Hanuman, Hanuman came up there, and Hanuman, they said, oh, now Hanuman, you have to jump over this ocean and go there and bring Sita. And Hanuman said, oh my God, there's so much huge water here, I can't go. And then there was an old person there. He was in the mythology, he's pictured as a bear. His name was Jambavan. Have you heard of Jambavan, some of you? So that this Jambavan was a very old, venerable person who had known this Hanuman from the time Hanuman was a baby. And then this Jambavan goes and tells Hanuman, what? How can he say you can't do it? Don't you remember? As a little boy, you have gone and you have done this and you have done that. And then that Hanuman's memory comes. Some of you may have seen that TV Ramayana, Ramanand Sagar. And then that memory comes. And Hanuman says, yes, I can do it. And he simply leaps across the ocean. So that's what has happened. We don't have to become the Atman. We are already the Atman. We are all, every one of us is already a spirit right now. This very minute, we are already the spirit. But we have forgotten it. And what can be simpler than just remembering what we have forgotten? So what this text say is not that you need to go and do something to become spirit. Just actually stop doing. Stop being human, and then you automatically know you are divine.
I'd feel better about that calling it the ultimate fulfillment of our humanity rather than the rejection of our humanity.
Yeah, well, this depends. The thing is this. When you say our humanity, the thing is, because we are identified with it, we call it our. I personally don't have any problem even with the word rejection. Why should I not reject something which I am not? If clinging on to something which I am not is bringing me pain, why should I not reject it? And that's, so you know, I personally don't have any problem with rejection. The word rejection becomes problematic if I think like humanity is something intrinsic to my being. If it is not something intrinsic, then of course, you know, ultimately it's this. When we say that we are really the spirit, then of course the question is, if I am spirit, then what happens to all this matter? Okay, I become spirit now, where does this matter go and stay? Now, if it's true that everything is really one, oneness is the ultimate reality, then this division between spirit and matter itself doesn't exist. What Vedanta formulates is this way, that the reality is one. The same reality I see as matter, and when my eyes open, I will see the same reality as spirit. So there is no duality. So really when you say I'm rejecting my humanity, what I'm really doing is rejecting my wrong notion of who I truly am. That's what is meant. It's like this. The classical example given in Vedanta is, suppose you have a coiled rope in a room which is not lighted. Not lighted in the sense, not enough light. There is kind of a dim light and there is a coiled rope. And you go into that room and you say, wow, there is a snake here. And of course, then you switch on the light and say, oh no, it's only a rope. It was not a snake. Now, when you saw the rope, when you switched on the light and saw there a rope, where did the snake go? You see, there is no rope and snake duality there. There was just one entity. That one entity I thought to be a snake, and then when I switched on the light, I knew it was a rope. That's it. At present, it's just one reality. I'm seeing it as matter. I'm seeing it as a human being. And you switch on the light, the inner light of consciousness, and that same thing which I saw as a human being, I see it as a divine being. So really nothing is being rejected. We're just seeing it with clear eyes, that's all. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, in your presence it looks like, you know, we get Atman, but keeping our everyday work, it gets forgotten, you know, how...
That's why we have to remind, which is why daily prayer, daily meditation, all this, which will come later on in this text, the importance of spiritual practice, importance of japa, taking the name of God, the importance of music, importance of study, importance of karma yoga, all of these practices, if done in the proper way, will help me remove my wrong notions. And yeah, so we have to, since it is so easy to forget, we have to find ways of reminding ourselves about it more and more often. So I think we'll continue this tomorrow evening and then on Sunday evening. So we'll stop now. So I think I'll end with a small prayer. Om Jananim Saradam Devim Ramakrishnam Jagatgurum Padapatme Tayo Shritva Pranamami Muhur Muhu. We bow down to Sri Ramakrishna and Holy Mother again and again.